Good evening. Can people hear me all right? In our collected literature, or as I call them, our Zen campfire tales, there's a lot of game playing going on. And the other day I was looking at something or other, and the commentator was saying, if you miss the point of this story, you lose your body and your life. And I thought, that's one of those Zen games. You don't lose anything. What kind of a life would it be that if you don't get the joke, you could lose it? Yeah, there isn't any such life. If the trick is, the pivot is, it's good to know that there's no such life. That is, there's no life you can lose. This is pretty important. I understand it's not the usual way of thinking. In spite of the potent teaching of the Heart Sutra that we just recited, which is pretty much telling us that our usual way of seeing things is quite inaccurate. So our usual way of seeing things is, they're born and then they live for a while and then they die and they're not around anymore. So that's not our actual life. One way or another, I think maybe not all, but almost all cultures have kind of flirted with the idea of immortality. In the West, there was a tradition of alchemical wisdom, and The exoteric interpretation is that that was the idea was to be able to transmute what looked like settled inert substances, change their nature by subjecting them to alchemical processes. But the esoteric teaching was about transforming the spirit and achieving, if not immortality, then remarkable longevity due to the power of the transformed spirit. And in various Asian cultures also, people were interested in prolonging life. And so the Taoists in China developed various processes, some types of physical culture, including diet, and also experimentally ingesting substances which were thought to be able to preserve and lengthen, perhaps in endlessly, the life force. Unfortunately, some of those substances turned out to be poisonous. So that was probably a wake-up call. Generally, ingesting mercury is not a real good idea, and nor is drinking lacquer. So it's like there too, I think some people got stuck on the exoteric teaching and did not realize that the esoteric teaching was not quite so literal. And so I brought this thing that my Dharma brother brought back from China for me. This gadget is called a Nyo-Yi.
What is it called?
Nyo-Yi.
Nyo-Yi.
Nyo-Yi. N-Y-O-I.
Is that Japanese or Chinese?
That's Japanese. Nyo-Yi means according to your will. And this particular one is quite anyway, I like it a lot, and I was very grateful to my friend Taigen for giving it to me. The design here is I thought for a long time it was a cloud, but it's not. It's actually a mushroom, and it's a mushroom that the Japanese call reishi. And it's regarded as the mushroom of immortality. So here's another tale about doing something and staving off or avoiding the ordinary cycle of birth and death. But in the Zen world, that's not what's meant by immortality. Now, this mushroom is meant to remind us that the life you can lose is not your actual life. Your actual life has no beginning and no end. And the apparent cycle of arising and passing away is inside our actual life. So when the body stops moving and decays, you don't go anywhere. And when you're born and you pop out of your mom, you don't arrive. So the Chan teachers carry this device as a reminder to everyone that the life we rejoice in is the life you can't lose. Yeah, I know that's not the usual way of looking at our life, but it's the Buddha way of looking at life. with that knowledge, you might say, replacing the what my friend Robert Thurman calls the misknowledge that we arrive from somewhere and then after a while we go off somewhere else. Once that misknowledge is dislodged, then our whole sense of our life is released. And then if someone tries to catch you in one of those Zen games, and it's like, oh, you didn't answer my question right, so you lost your body and your life. And then you can say, oh, don't kid a kidder, buddy. Uh-uh. Based on your own life that you recognize as not limited. The whole cycle of birth and death is inside of life. I was also reflecting the other day that from this perspective, past, you know, we're also accustomed to thinking of past and future as kind of literally existing maybe not exactly realms, but I don't know, continuities of some kind. That they're actually there. Past is back there somewhere. Future's up there ahead. But I think from the perspective of our actual life, past and future are shadows cast by the brilliance of our actual life. The light of our actual life casts these shadows kind of seeming out there and back there. And that's all past and future are. Because the radiance of our actual life is only here. And there is only now for that radiance. So sometimes our teachers remind us, don't get hung up in the shadows. There's nothing back there. There's nothing up there. There's only the light of now. The discourse of Chan and Zen, that's what's meant by immortality. So don't go drinking lacquer or mercury. Cultivate this practice we have of dwelling simply now. And let those shadows fall away. And I guess usually it seems like bit by bit or over time, the misknowledge that we have acquired, possibly over many, many lifetimes, is eroded and ceases to have a grip. on our thinking, our mind, and our actual body and our actual life are revealed. I only carry this usually in ceremonies, and I carry it because my teacher said I could, and I respect him, so I think, okay. So he said, well, no, you can't carry that, then I probably wouldn't. But the assumption is that I understand that I am carrying this to encourage and support all of us to come to know our actual life, our genuine claim, if you like, on immortality. And we can move from the exoteric misknowledge that, I was born and pretty soon I'm going to be dead. We can move behind that to the actual knowledge of what our life is like. And from that perspective, also, all of those Zen jokes, they actually get pretty funny instead of just ridiculous or frustrating. And actually, those guys are pretty cute, actually. And if someone tries to tell you, oh, you just lost your life, don't believe it. So someone says, okay, what is Buddha? And you go, too late. You can say, don't rush me, I want to think about it. That light is pretty bright, and sometimes it's so bright we turn away from it, you know. And sometimes when two people meet, their respective lights kind of merge. Well, actually, I think that always happens. But sometimes people get pretty carried away by that, and they call it love. Oh, I'm in love. I mean, let's face it, that feels pretty good when it happens. And then sometimes people they realize that that light is in everybody. So maybe that means I love everybody. Not in quite the same way. I was looking at a video the other day, and this was one of Thich Nhat Hanh's videos, a recording made, I think, relatively recently at Plum Village, and. Because I think it was relatively recent, because Thay wasn't looking so great. I think this is after his stroke. But he was up for having some discussion, and somebody asked, why doesn't Buddha talk about romantic love? And Thay said, well, actually, Buddha is always talking about romantic love. And I kind of thought, what? And bear in mind, his specialty, Thay's specialty, is kind of processing Buddhism for a very wide Western audience. He doesn't teach the same way to his monastics. At Plum Village, there's like the Dharma Center where everybody goes, and then there's a monastic enclave, and he doesn't teach the same way up on the hill and down. So I doubt he was telling his monastics, oh, Buddha's always teaching romantic love. So he said, because by romantic love, I mean, he says, true love. And then he says, and true love, the way Buddha taught, has four characteristics. And then he proceeds to use the four Brahma Viharas, which you may have heard of before. What does Kanza call them? Before illimitable sublime moods. And I thought that was a little dodgy for him to do that. But anyway, so he says, true love is characterized by like friendliness and compassion and joy and equanimity, which, of course, those are the four Brahma Viharas. And I thought, well, that's a little slippery there, Thay. And I thought, well, let me see. Were my relationships characterized by... Yeah, no. So I guess I missed that boat. It would be, I think, very transformative of relationships for people to proceed on that basis and say, okay, we are going to be involved romantically, so let's try to bring to bear the four Brahma Viharas in our relationship and see how that goes. That would be, I'd like to be a fly on the wall for that. Now, personally, I don't have relationships. I'm a monk, a monastic, so I set aside that path. And I'm also pretty old, so it's a lot easier than it used to be. And recently I was kind of feeling like I think I have finally achieved celibacy after many years. And what I mean by that, well, I guess I sort of mean I'm not referring to the obvious, namely that I don't get involved with people sexually. I mean uh the way of relating to people is more and more on the basis of our actual life and not so much on, okay, here comes this being, and how many of my boxes of delightful characteristics do I check off this one? It's like, yeah, well, that's pretty good. Oh, no, forget it. Or, oh, here comes a, whoa, look at this one, check. To relate to people like that is, well, it's exhausting, for one thing. And it's not really conducive to friendliness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. So, when I found myself on the path of celibacy, I wasn't always altogether pleased, but I thought, I think I will stick with this. Because, among other things, when people are relating to you on the basis of your treading the path of the Buddha way, they need you to be safe. They need you to be safe. They need to know that you're not going to cross a certain boundary into their life and mess with them. And if you do cross that boundary, it almost never is not a disaster. So my teacher made that pretty clear to me, and I said, yeah, okay. And I don't have... It's not much of a claim to fame to say that I've avoided disaster. It's like, yeah, okay, great, congratulations. But that's one of my few claims to fame, that I've avoided disaster. And to negotiate our life and our world on the basis of our light, our actual being. Yeah, I don't think I'd give that up for anything. Not like it's something I have, but if I could give it up, I don't think I would. I wouldn't trade it, for instance, for, oh, look at a hot number coming along here. It's like, nah, I wouldn't do that. So that means we all already partake of the immortality that is worth anything. And that's pretty good news, I would say. And that we can live our life on that basis. And it will be helpful to continue this practice of basically just sitting in the light, not doing anything, and not trying to like make it brighter, just sitting with it as it is, and letting so much of the superfluous stuff we haul around with us fall away. Yes, Grasshopper.
A little while ago, I thought I heard you say that our present life, this moment, is our only light, our only life, the only time. Like firewood and ash, I guess.
Well, I didn't say that firewood stuff, but I did say that other stuff, yeah.
And past and future are shadows. And what I would, and I relate that to mental formations, ideas, stories, projections.
All those have a shadowy quality, yeah.
and particularly stories, projections about the past and the present as having some actual and some sense of reality.
Or the future, yeah.
Yeah, the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some resonance with teachings that in fact the present is also, that is our projection, our perception of the present is also a mental formation.
Yes.
A projection, a attribution.
There is that. And one teaching that you may know is that in fact the present has none of those projections in it. In fact. And
thoroughly established.
That is called the completely realized. Yes. Right. So I'm completing your thought there, but
no, I think I think that was the completion of my thought.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Can I make a confession before my question?
Of course.
I still think someone can take my life from me.
Yes. Well, but that is a thought.
Yes.
That's all. Yeah.
And my question is looking at the nyo.
Nyoi.
Nyoi.
Yes.
To me, it looks like a skeleton and a brain.
Yes, I think I've heard that one too, but these are all little mushrooms all along here.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the big mushroom up here.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
This does have the curve, however, of the spine. And sometimes the teacher will come along. Put it on your back. It's like, okay, let's get it straightened up there. That's also for that. That's no accident either.
Well, it's possible not to think of it as a vertebrae.
Yeah, I guess.
A vertebral column.
Yeah, this one looks like a little guy with eyes and teeth, as a matter of fact. That's also a mushroom. Yeah.
So I think I heard you say that this is what I heard, I think. Is that our true life or our spiritual life is going on behind the life of birth and death.
I may have said that.
Yeah. So when you said that, I thought of the wheel of life. And behind the wheel of life is a demon. And so I thought, well, that doesn't sound like our true life, the demon.
No.
So
well, it looks like the demon is behind the wheel, but actually the demon is spinning it for us. Yeah. He's actually, or she, or it, or they, are turning it.
Driving it.
Yes, driving it, right. And, of course, when you flip it around, so to speak, and see our actual life, the demon is then suddenly a Buddha. So in the Buddha way, demons are always just the flip side of a bodhisattva. There are no actual demons stuck in being demons. They've all been, the ones who were demons, they've all been turned into Dharma protectors. So that's a pretty good deal. So you don't really have to, you know, that's just propaganda up there.
Thank you.
I'm going to uncork myself here.
Okay. Do you know what the green dragon symbolizes, like a green dragon temple out there in Green Gulch?
Well, I'm not sure that the color matters very much, right? That's green dragon because it's Green Gulch, but dragons come in all colors. And the important thing is, as Dogen says, is to recognize the true dragon. Right? Whatever color he, she, or it manifests in. And you know the story about the dragon carver? You know that story? No?
Oh.
Well, there was a great artist who loved to carve dragons, and he made these beautiful carvings. And, you know, people were like lining up to get these gorgeous carvings of dragons. And a dragon heard about this. And one night appeared at the carver's window, said, "Hi, you're doing a great job." And the guy fainted dead away. So he was not ready for the true dragon. But we can be. And, of course, the true dragon is no particular person's possession.
So what does the dragon represent? The Buddha nature?
Or is it you.
Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The true you.
Okay.
Yeah.
You are not it. In truth, it is you.
And my teacher likes that quote. I can't remember who that's from. Somebody like Master Ma or one of those guys said, how's it go? How many times have I gone down into the cave of the black dragon for you? I like that one.
Friendliness.
Turn it on.
It is on.
Thank you.
Or is it not?
I can hear you pretty well.
I didn't turn anything here. I thought it was on. Oh, okay. So you gave it to me turned on.
He's the master of ceremonies.
Friendliness. I see a great deal of energy in friendliness, as I see a great deal of energy in celibacy. And I also see that my life is a bowl of energy. And you mentioned that you have not been burned. Or you alluded to that using other words?
I avoided disaster. I had, not so much in my earlier years, but since coming to the Buddha Way, I have managed to avoid disaster, yes.
And I equated that to being burned. And so in this friendliness, is there an intention not to be burnt? And in celibacy, is there an intention not to be burnt?
Well, I guess I would say that the intention is not to burn someone else. And in so doing, one can avoid a mutual conflagration. So the actual effort is to avoid burning someone else. And in so doing, it creates a kind of a realm of safety for both. If someone's trying to burn us, we may want to back away a bit. And that does happen. When I was at the monastery, someone who was a neighbor of mine on the sitting platform had drawn the attention of, I think, a guest during the summer. A lady guest, and he was a guy. And so during Zazen, she would come to the the gallery around the meditation hall and stand outside his window and whisper his name. Oh, Cliff! Eventually, the Eno would come and chase her away, but he had to like back away from her, practically run every time he would see her coming, because he's like, okay, you are too hot for me right now, and I want to avoid a mutually incendiary event. So, please. So that's okay. You finished, Raphael?
I am.
Yeah, okay.
Regarding celibacy, many Zen teachers in America and Japan are married.
Yes.
So what's with that?
Well, that's another approach, and that is a way to enclose the energy of not harming within a marriage, within a vow structure. And what's important there is that energy remain inside. And if it starts to leak out, well, you get disasters of one kind or another.
Get burned.
Yeah. Yeah. Badly sometimes. Yes.
I thought I had heard there was even a national law or something in Japan where monks had to marry. Was that made up?
It's kind of actually a complicated story, but you know that right now, for instance, in China, the government is very upset with the Muslims. And not only the Muslims, they get upset with any group that seems to be getting big enough to challenge the government. Okay, so something similar happened in Japan, and there were so many Buddhists and so many temples and so many priests, and the government wanted to exert some degree of control there. So they made certain requirements. For instance, they set it up so that every family had to register with a temple. And this way, it's like the entire population could be associated with a particular temple. So it's like broke up larger groups into smaller groups. They also said that laws, the previous laws, which forbade monastics from marrying, were suspended. So the government established these principles called Nikujiki Saitai, which meant that, let's see, that means basically meat eating and clerical marriage, which meant that people could police themselves. And the government was not going to have any particular... government didn't want to be involved in policing those relationships. So go ahead and have them. As you probably know, that in Japan, the tradition of the Vinaya precepts, the 250 precepts for men and 347 for women, didn't last much past the, you know... began to change in like the 8th century, and by Dogen's time, that was basically not happening in Japan. So monastics received the Bodhisattva precepts, basically the same as we do, and their conduct was regulated by what was called the Shingi, which is the pure rules for monastic communities. So that was kind of a shift away from an elaborate, very specific set of precepts to a broad set of precepts set in the context of a very exacting code of conduct for those who lived in monastic communities. So that was a shift. And that remains to this day. And there are still monastics who take the Vinaya precepts, and there are others who take the Bodhisattva precepts instead, and depend upon the conduct of their community, the code of conduct, for their behavior. So there was a time when, especially after the Meiji Restoration, when there was some pressure on monastics to marry, because that brought them more into the fabric of Japanese society as a whole and lessened their power. At least that's one explanation. And now it's still the custom for Japanese priests to be married. That's still the custom. And in fact, I think there's still some pressure now from the culture, not from the government anymore. But like if a young priest goes to take over a temple, the danka, member families, will get together and say, well, why don't we set him up with so-and-so, you know? And then she becomes a temple wife, which is not, I don't know, from what I saw, you really have to be into it, you know, because you'd be like cooking and cleaning and mending his robes and taking care of guests and from dawn to dusk and beyond, and it's really rough. You know, I don't know why anybody would want to do that, but I guess they do. Yes?
I think it might be changing.
Hmm.
We stayed at Rinzo Inn.
Yes.
The monastery of Suzuki Roshi's family.
Temple, really.
Yeah, excuse me, temple.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of cooking, the temple wife went out to the grocery store and bought us box sushi.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Here, have some.
here's your dinner.
There you go. She's an advanced practitioner.
So, you know, it was very modern. It wasn't like, you know, let me slave over a lot of stuff here. No.
Now, was that Chitase-san, Hoetsu's wife?
No, or it was Kumi.
Okay. Shingo's wife.
The younger.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right. Yeah, she's smart.
And rather than make us lunch the next day?
Yeah.
No, let me take you out to my local.
Oh, very good.
This is where I like to go.
This is advanced practice. Yeah.
So, might be changing.
Yeah, maybe. Well, oh, yes? Sure.
Well, just hopefully there are other models of coupling that are within the realm of our spiritual practice that
mm-hmm.
don't divide men and women into roles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a patriarchal understanding of relationships.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just have to say that.
Yeah. Well, the sphere, the enclosure of a committed romantic relationship is a tremendous crucible of practice. Oh, yes, no doubt about that. Well, maybe that's enough for tonight. Thank you all very much for your practice.